Okay, here we are at the end of another week already. It's the middle of February, and we're rolling on, rolling as fast as we can possibly roll, whether we like it or not. The story tonight is going to be fascinating. We're going to go back into World War II and look at an extraordinary event, which obviously is a tiny little footnote in time and history, but it is a big story. It has to do with Germany and Japan. And as the war was winding down, the technological lead that the Germans had achieved was extraordinary by any measure, over the Allies, over anybody. And they were trying to share that with the Japanese. And how they made that attempt is truly an extraordinary story. And speaking of extraordinary, the website of our guest, Shark Hunters, is just an amazing place to go and spend some time. Harry Cooper is back tonight. He, of course, the creator of Shark Hunters, the historical archive of the U-boats of World War II, and really much more than that. Harry, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to be back.
My pleasure on this end, and there were a lot of people listening tonight. They want to hear this story, and they always enjoy hearing you. As I said before, and I'll repeat it to you folks who may be new, there could be no better representative to speak on behalf of the incredibly brave men who served in the U-boat forces in World War II. Remember, six of seven never came back.
Yeah, they had a terrible attrition rate, but they kept right on going because it was their duty.
Well, I remember the first time we visited, you said even at the end of the war, when so-called peace prevailed, they were still lined up to enlist, even though they know in their hearts that they were going to die. They're right there.
Yeah, it was their duty.
The other issue I want to mention before we get into our story tonight is Dresden.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
We're coming up on the anniversary of that, I believe.
Yes, we are. I hope all of you listening are well familiar with it by now. I've spent a lot of time on the subject, certainly Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s memoirs of that astonishing Holocaust, Stand Tall. He survived it. I think he was in a meat locker, underground or nearly underground. It was the wholesale liquidation of human life.
Yeah.
There's no strategic value in Dresden as a military objective. That's a given. That's why the city was packed with refugees. It was a safe city. It was an old city, famous for its porcelain china and art. And there may have been 600,000-700,000 people, 800,000 people. No one knows how many people were in Dresden when the British and the Americans, but especially the butchering, barbarous Brits under Churchill and his Bolshevik bankster controllers, decided to make an example of how brutal and ruthless the opposition of their will can be. So they pulled Dresden. Nobody knows how many people die there. I see the laughably underestimated reports of 40,000 dead.
I think that is underestimated, yeah.
Well, it could be 500,000, and that's the ballpark figure is 400,000 and up.
Yeah.
And these people died horrific deaths. They weren't just bombed and blown apart. The incendiaries that were dropped over this defenseless town turned it into a conflagration. Human beings literally melted. They melted away to nothing. And if you look on the internet, you can find stories about it and see the pictures. And I would urge you to take a look. It's the most graphic, abject lesson at the insanity of humankind. And we are becoming, unfortunately, no better in that regard as the years roll by. Okay, tonight's topic, Harry Cooper, is, set the stage for us. The time of the war, what was going on, and let's take it from there.
Okay, this was at the very close of the war in the last few weeks. Germany was all but finished, and the handwriting was on the wall. They couldn't hold out much longer, and they were trying to get as much of their technology, personnel, etc., to Japan in the hopes that Japan could have enough impact to where the U.S. would pull back. They were sending several of their large boats, the Type 9D2 or the Type 10Bs, like U-234,
mm-hmm.
sending them to Japan with a lot of them had uranium on board. They had either ME-163 rocket fighters on board or ME-262 jet fighters on board, all crated up with the technological data for the Japanese to begin making them. And the Japanese had test-fired their first atomic weapon 1 week before the U.S. test-fired ours. But the Japanese had no more fissionable material, and so Germany was sending that. All the boats got ambushed and sunk because the Allies had broken the code, and they knew where which submarine was carrying it, and they had a British sub waiting over the top of Denmark to ambush them. And except for this boat, U-234, her skipper was a wily old merchant skipper before the war. And he was also the weapons demolitions officer on board the Raider Atlantis in the early part of the war. So he figured, well, if I keep going the way I'm supposed to go, I'm not going to get very far because my buddies didn't. So he went a different way. And he was in the North Atlantic when the surrender order came. And they surrendered to the U.S. where they figured they'd get better treatment rather than go to the Brits, especially not to the Russians.
Of course. I saw the other day, in fact, I'm going to try and do a story on this, the horrific slaughter that the Russians perpetrated against German civilians trying to escape on large ships. Cargo vessels and so forth, they would torpedo them and laugh as the boats went down.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands and thousands died.
The Wilhelm Gustloff had probably the worst loss of life of any maritime disaster ever over. We did an article on that. More than 10,000 people were on board that boat. And we know the story of the skipper of the submarine, too. He didn't fare much better. He had been through the ranks. He was not one of the aristocracy. He was just a farm boy that somehow managed to become a submarine commander. But he was a horrendous drunk. And after he sank the Gustloff, they came back to their port, which was in the city of Baltiisk, which used to be Pillau until the Russians overran it. And instead of docking, he flooded down onto the bottom of the harbor and sat there and got roaring drunk. And eventually, the KGB opened a file on him, and that was the end. He was only 50-something years old when he died from alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. Russia still has an horrific alcoholism problem today.
Yeah, I know. I've been to Russia several times, and they take like a 6-ounce or an 8-ounce clear glass bottle with a screw cap full of vodka, no label, nothing fancy. And they just open the bottle, pour it in a glass, and drink it. Pour it in a glass and drink it. No mix, no ice, no nothing. There's no way you're going to drink with a Russian.
No.
I had to tell him I had bad liver, so I could drink Pepsi, but it's not vodka. Please, Guri, nothing dying here in Russia.
The average life expectancy of Russian men is much less than any other Western country.
Yeah, they have a terrible alcohol problem.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break and come right back. We're going to talk about, again, the amazing story, the more amazing cargo of the U-234. Now, there was a PBS special done on this. I'll put this up under Harry Cooper's name, and all of you can click and watch the actual story of this, some extraordinary footage. And we'll pick up the story with Harry of Shark Hunters in just a minute. Okay, and we're back with Harry Cooper. If you click on Harry's name, you'll go right to sharkhunters.com. If you click under Harry's name at rents.com, You'll go to the text and see it right there, The Incredible Story of U-234, and that'll take you to a page of images, photos, that Harry provided for tonight's discussion. They're all there, and it's quite a story. All right, Harry, when you talk about putting uranium on a submarine, okay, people can say, all right, well, we can see that. Was this heavily refined processed uranium, or was it pretty raw? What do we know?
That's a good question. The translation of the manifest, which you have a copy, shows it as uranium oxide. One of our members, a fellow named Carter Plimpton Heydrich, did a lot of research on it, and he believed that it was enriched weapons grade.
Mm-hmm.
560 kilos of it, which is about 1,100 or 1,200 pounds. And the United States was short on fissionable material as well,
mm-hmm.
and it is generally thought that this material was used in our bomb over Hiroshima. But for some strange reason, all the paperwork has evaporated.
You know what's interesting? Somebody made a very cogent and compelling story that the bombs we dropped on Japan actually came from Germany, at least one of them.
That's what we believe, researchers believe, that at least the first one, the uranium bomb over Hiroshima, incidentally, it's not Hiroshima like the new left-wing press wants to pronounce it. I asked a Japanese friend of mine, and he was laughing. He's probably still laughing. There's no place called Hiroshima. It's
right.
Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, that's it's generally believed that that's what happened to that uranium. But as I say, the paperwork has all vanished.
Yeah.
Amazing how that happened, eh?
Yeah. Now, this was a submarine originally designed and commissioned to serve as what?
A mine layer. It was the biggest type submarine that Germany had in World War II, 294 feet long, I think it is, and 1,800 tons, something like that. And it was designed as a mine layer. It had mine laying tubes amidships. I'm sorry, fore and aft inside the ship that extended through, and mine tubes along the sides. So they could carry three mines in each tube.
Mm-hmm.
But this boat never did go out on an operational patrol. By the time it was ready to go, mine laying was a waste of time because the Allies were sweeping the mines, and if the submarine even got in to lay the mines, chances are she was going to get sunk anyhow.
Right.
So it was just sitting dockside. And when this operation was going to go on, they brought her back into the shipyard and took out all the mine tubes in the ship, the fore and aft ones.
Yeah, you can see that, folks, if you look at the pictures. Scroll down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 pictures down. You'll see the U-234 with an arrow pointing at the mine tubes, top deck in front of the bridge. That's a
right,
big ship.
Yeah, the big black boat. Arrow?
Yep.
Yeah. Those are the ones that got taken out. You probably can't see it from here. The one on the cutaway drawing, they're highlighted in different colors. The ones that the arrow is pointing at in this photo, those were the ones that were removed. And, of course, the hull was sealed again so it could dive. And they packed this thing so full of cargo. I sent you some pages of the cargo manifest and many tons of this and how many tons of that. And the paperwork, tons and tons of documents and paperwork, including everything the Japanese needed to build the ME-323, called the Gigant, which was a six-engine cargo plane.
Extraordinary transport, huge.
Yeah, monster-sized airplane.
Yeah, yeah. What's really remarkable is that this was not the only submarine trying to take this technology to Japan, and the Japanese were quite ready to make duplicates, and again, 6 more months would have changed the complexion of the war to a substantial degree. It wouldn't have reversed things, but it would have made it much more interesting, as they say, a remotely fighting chance for the other side, rather than be continually just flattened and desecrated as a culture and a society. How many submarines were sent to Japan, approximately, that we know about, with advanced cargoes?
We believe about six. In addition to U-234, there's another very famous one, U-864, which was not fortunate to get through the blockade. The British sub, I think it was HMS Swordfish, I'm not positive, I'm going off the top of my head here, but there was a British sub waiting for U-864 as it was going to transit the Denmark Straits, and she was sunk off of Norway.
Right.
With all hands went down on it. They had an ME-163 rocket plane on board, freighted up with all the documentation. And we've known where this boat is, 10, 15 years, we've known where it was. And suddenly, about 5, 6, 7 years ago, the Norwegians decided the mercury on board was going to leak and destroy their fishing grounds. And we believe the mercury on board was carried as quicksilver on the manifest. We believe that was the uranium. The Norwegian authorities decided they were going to raise the submarine with no regard to the 77 men left aboard. And a submarine that's been sitting in the water, well, in the first place, a submarine that's hit by a torpedo is blown into several pieces. And after sitting 70 years on the bottom, it's pretty well rusted apart, and so there's not much left of it. So raising it would just scatter the human remains all over the ocean.
Right.
And they can't even have the honorable idea that we'll rebury the remains, because you can't even tell. They look like stones or pieces of wood unless you find a skull. It's not going to, like in the old pirate movies, you know,
sure.
with the white skeleton.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They just decided, so what? And they got the German government, and today's German government is a real puppet. And the German government says, yeah, we don't care. So we've been having a fight with them, and I've had my members email to the Department of Fisheries and tell them that we're outraged. So at last, they're thinking about, instead of trying to raise this boat, they're going to encase it in cement on the ocean bottom. Nobody objects to that.
Nobody.
Well, they're not going to disturb the men in their iron coffin.
Understand.
As opposed to raising it up and dropping pieces of everything all over the place.
Of course. All right, stand by, and we'll continue with Harry Cooper in just a few minutes. Okay, the U-234 actually left and is the only one of half a dozen submarines packed with Germany's most advanced technology. And you did hear Harry Cooper correctly. The Japanese had exploded an atomic weapon before the Americans did in New Mexico. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but that's interesting in and of itself. We could also ask about the German program. I've had people on this program tell me that there were small nuclear weapons actually in railroad cars, I believe in Austria at the end of the war, waiting to be used, but for some reason the decision was made not to use them. I can't validate or verify that, but tell us a little bit more about this, the nuclear aspect of it, because the cargo, again, of enriched uranium was obviously going to be used for bombs.
Right. The uranium on board U-234 was consigned to the Japanese Army. And for the Japanese nuclear program, there's a book called Japan's Secret War, written by a fellow named Robert Wilcox, who's member number 25 of Shark Hunters. We're up to member number 7,700 and something. So he was on board early. And he had a lot of data about that. And through his research, we followed it even further, and we contacted, the skipper of U-234 was a member of Shark Hunters, and I spent a day with him in his home talking about his last trip. The first officer was a member, the cargo officer was a member, and the chief radioman was a member. So we picked up a lot. We also picked up a lot of, I don't know. When I asked the skipper about his cargo of uranium, he looked a little nervous. This was in 1988. He looked a little nervous and said, well, chemistry was my worst subject in university, so I don't know anything about that.
Oh.
Yeah, and when I asked the cargo officer, he said, I didn't know what the product was. All I knew was the size, shape, and weight of all the packages so I could trim out the boat properly.
How interesting.
Yeah. The chief radioman finally opened up many years after the war. His name was Wolfgang Hirschfeld. He's quite a guy. He knew a lot of about the secret projects. And also there was one of their top scientists was one of the passengers, a guy named Heinz Schlicke, who was one of the world's leading scientists on magnetic suppression, you know, for submarines to remain invisible. He was a member of Shark Hunters also, and he got scooped up in Operation Paperclip after the war ended, and
right.
He wound up going to Milwaukee working for the Allen Bradley Company, working on anti-submarine devices.
This is all interesting. Okay, we've talked about the cargo a bit, enriched uranium on the U-234, a Messerschmitt, I guess
262.
It was the jet, the 262.
Right.
They had the 163 Comet was on another one, right?
Yes, that was on submarine U-864.
Okay, so we got a 262 Messerschmitt. We've got enriched uranium. What else was on board?
There were literally hundreds of tons of documents, and they had documents on how to build the motors for the Schnell boats, how to build the ME-323 cargo plane. What the heck else here? I'm looking at the ammunition for recoilless rifles, anti-tank rifles. They had documents. They had detonators, optical glass, you name it. They had it on board.
These were just treasuries of technology.
Exactly.
Boats.
The Japanese were not advancing anywhere near as rapidly as the Germans, and so the Germans were, you know, they were reluctant to share this with Japan until finally they needed Japan to pull their fat out of the fire. If Japan could have gotten at least one of these nuclear weapons working and dropped it amidst our Pacific fleet over there off of Okinawa,
right,
it would have caused the U.S. fleet to pull back for a while.
Yeah.
But the Japanese never got the chance because the submarines were all sunk that were carrying uranium except for U-234.
Yeah, and the reason the boats were intercepted and sunk was, again, an issue of code breaking, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ever since Black May 1943, that was when the codes were really broken and the Allies were reading the German transmissions as fast as the Germans were.
This is, this is amazing. It's like playing a football game and knowing exactly what the opponent is going to run at you each play.
Exactly. And if you know what the other guy is going to do, you can pretty well win the
war. This is amazing. The Germans really didn't have a chance, and yet look how valiantly they fought.
Right.
I'm not talking about Nazis here. I'm talking about Germans, people.
You're good soldiers.
Absolutely.
They did. I think, and I've told this to my German friends so many times, that they had some of the best soldiers, the best fighter pilots, etc. But when it came to the spy business, they were horrible because you got to be able to lie and be sneaky to be a spy. And the Germans, I know, they couldn't lie. They couldn't be sneaky.
What's really unknown and tragically so about World War II is how honorable the German military was compared to any other army on the battlefield.
Yeah, that's true.
It's their culture.
The U-boat guys, I remember growing up in the wartime, we were told they machine gun helpless survivors in the water for sport, etc., which is propaganda, and you need that in a war, I guess, but it just never happened. They would surface and give fresh water and food to the guys in the water and give them a compass course so they could get saved. And in one case, when the submarine U-156 sank the British liner Laconia, the skipper Hartenstein broadcast in clear on the international distress frequency that this submarine had sunk a British ship, and there were thousands of survivors. They were rescuing them, and if any Allied ship would like to come and help, there would be no combat, just help these people in the water. Well, they sent a bomber out to try to kill him.
Yeah. Also, I have a video up in a featured story box called The Other Side of the Coin. It's about World War II, taking another look at history as it has been so perverted by the Zionist West. And that story of the BF-109 ace Franz Stiegler and the B-17 pilot Charlie Brown meeting is up there. That's a video, and you really want to see that.
Oh, yeah.
It's an amazing.
He could have shot that bomber down and put another notch on the side of his plane, but
exactly,
he had some compassion.
Yep, a human being. Okay, Harry Cooper is here. When we come back, I want to talk about the people on board this boat and the others, because they were some of the highest-ranking German military and scientists who went down with these ships as well. Back in a minute. Okay, back with Harry Cooper. Who were some of the men? What type of people were part of the cargo of this boat, this U-234?
Okay,
and who was
in the way of scientists, as I say, Dr. Schlicker.
Uh-huh.
Then there were two Japanese officers who were also experts in their field. One was in submarine expert, and the other was a an aviation expert. Tomonaga was one guy's name. I can't remember the other.
And how did they get to Germany?
No, they got to Germany by other submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And they went over there to learn about the German submarines and the German aviation program, and they were their way back home. And U-234 got the surrender order, and they decided to surrender in the United States so their crew would be treated better than anywhere else. And, of course, Japan was still at war with the United States, and these two poor officers, they held the rank of Kapitän Leutnant, which is the same as a lieutenant commander. They were stuck. They didn't want to surrender to the United States because dishonorable, so they committed suicide on board the boat. Not by the time-honored harakiri of cutting your innards out, but they took large quantities of phenobarbital, and it took them a long time to die, and they moaned and groaned, and nobody could help them because the boat was caught in a storm, and finally they died, and they were brought into the engine room to be sewn up into shrouds, and they were dropped overboard in a military funeral. They also had on board Lieutenant General or General Leutnant Ulrich Kessler, who was going to be the new naval attaché in Tokyo, and his whole staff was with him. They surrendered, of course. And they had a guy named Kai Naisling, who was what they call a Geschwader Richter. He was a fleet judge, and he was going to try all the traitors in the German embassy who were feeding information to the Soviets. The war ended, and they wound up in Portsmouth Naval Base rather than Tokyo.
All right.
And those guys all lived out the war.
Okay. Now, who were on some of the other subs? Do we have names? Do we know who was lost?
Yeah, but those boats have not been researched very well. They had scientists on board. They had high-ranking people. Germany was trying to get as much of their brain power out of Germany to Japan to carry on the war, but you know, the weight of the Allies was just well, overwhelming. Germany, the Axis were three countries. Germany, who bore most of the brunt of the fighting. Italy, which was really no help to the Germans at all. And Japan, and throughout the war, the Germans and the Japanese didn't trust each other. They didn't cooperate well. They were separated by very complex language problems. So basically it was Germany on her own in the European theater. And the Allies were 93 countries. Some countries, of course, nobody really cared about, like the Bahamas. They were right against Germany. But the United States had manufacturing capability like nothing before. The Russians could invest a couple of million people into this battle and a couple million more into the other. And the Germans were just overwhelmed by sheer weight of numbers.
Well, they actually could not kill their adversaries fast enough. It just was not possible.
Exactly.
As cruel and crude as that sounds.
Now, unfortunately, that's what happens in war. That's how you win a war.
Right. The pictures, and we take a look, first is the captain. Go ahead, let's take a look at some of these pictures now.
Okay, we'll look at the first picture. That's Johann Heinrich Fehler. Very nice gentleman. As I say, I spent a day in his house in Hamburg. He's dead now. But he's a character. He and I were talking. He was like 80-something years old at the time, and a young man of 16 walked into the room. They spoke in German. I didn't understand German at the time, and away mm-hmm. he went. I asked, is that your grandson? He said, oh, no, that's my son. He's 16. And Fehler was like 80-something years old. Mm-hmm. A tough guy. He was the demolitions officer on board the Raider Atlantis, and, you know, the joke was he could never do anything without blowing something up. He had to blow stuff up.
That's
and,
funny.
And there's a couple photos of the Atlantis there in the Kerguelen Islands, which was a safe haven for any of the boats. Then there's a picture of him at a reception. We don't know what this is for, but that's him in his uniform with 2.5 rings on his sleeve. Mm-hmm. He was, at that point, the rank of Kapitänleutnant, or Lieutenant Commander. And pardon me if I'm sounding a little raspy. I have a rare winter cold in Florida here.
You sound fine.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No problem.
Then there's a picture of the two officers, and Baylor's in the white hat in his leathers, and the other guy with 3 rings on his sleeve, which is Corvetten Capitaine, or the same as Commander in our Navy. And that's Heinrich Lehmann Willenbrook. And if you ever saw the movie Das Boot, he was the skipper depicted in that movie, the guy with the boat of the Smiling Sawfish.
So, again, he did not die in real life as he did in the movie.
Correct. It it just made for better filming to have the skipper.
Yeah, more drama. Yeah,
right,
sure.
To have the skipper die there. He had been transferred off his boat, Willenbrook, and he was commander of the 10th U-boat flotilla. And then when the Allies were about to overrun the bases there, the 5 bases along the French coast, he took command of U-256, and they all went up to Norway, and then he got a staff position, and they both lived out the war.
Okay, well, there's Fehler with that white hat and the beard. Looks like he has just come back from a patrol of some kind. He's got flowers.
Correct.
And very dashing. Look, unmistakable, those white hats.
And the white turtleneck. All the skip. Now, the white hat was not issue.
Understand.
But it was tradition.
Okay. Next picture, the crew, all on deck.
Yeah, they were treated pretty nicely. They didn't have any place to go for a while. Remember, that boat was tied up in port for some time. So they were having a picnic on deck. They didn't get to see much of the sun once they got onto a mission.
No, I wouldn't think so. The next picture is an emblem, a mine. It appears to be a mine blowing up.
Correct.
And that would be the conning tower emblem on the boat because it was, again, a mine layer.
Right. And it was showing they were blowing up Satan, which I guess they figured was the Allies.
Well, America is still known as the Great Satan.
Yeah.
So, more things change and more they stay the same.
Yeah, true enough. True enough. And then, let's see, in the picture number 11 there, that's shot from the bridge of an American destroyer. destroyer escort. That would be the Sutton, USS Sutton. And there's a yellow circle. Now,
yeah.
Those are the mine-laying tubes that were outside the pressure hull. They still stayed on the boat.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have any mines in them, but they were still on the boat.
You look carefully at the flag on the submarine at that point, and it's the American flag.
Correct, yeah. And in picture 12, you can see some American or U.S. Navy officers on the tower of U-234 about to hoist the Stars and Stripes. And
how did the ship actually surrender? Done by radio? We're at this location. We're going to be on the surface.
Yeah, everybody knew what was on this boat, and the Brits wanted it, and the Americans wanted it. So the Brits told Thaler, no, you come directly to Halifax, and you report your speed and position every hour on the hour. So every hour on the hour, he reported a position where he would be if he was heading for Halifax at 8 knots, where in reality he was heading for Portsmouth at full speed. And finally, he met with the Sutton. This is many hundreds of miles offshore. The Sutton came alongside. They allowed the Germans to lower their flag. You know, Navy men are pretty much tied together by the sea. So the American crew let Thaler's crew take down their flag with proper ceremony and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Then most of the crew of the submarine came onto the American destroyer, but they left a skeleton crew on board under American guard to bring the boat into Portsmouth. And then Halifax radio come on the line and says, hey, you guys haven't reported in, and they got a reply back from the U.S. Navy destroyer escort saying, well, we're not going to Halifax, we're going to Portsmouth.
Well, if the British had been smart, they wouldn't have sunk all the other submarines. They would have tried to force them into surrendering somehow.
Yeah, they would have gotten something off it rather than just wiping them out.
Very stupid.
Yeah, and so when U-234 arrived in Portsmouth, she came in the middle of the night, and the next morning she was in dock, but there was a huge security curtain, 8-foot-high curtain all around the dock. Nobody was allowed to go there.
Huh.
Except one of our members wangled his way on board because the guy who was on guard duty was a friend of his, so he brought him on board, and he's the guy who got this manifest for us.
Now, the manifest is in English, so this is some kind of an inventory done by the Americans after the ship went into port, correct?
Right. That was, let's see, if you look on the main page, which is photo 15A, it shows that it was translated from the German on 23 May 1945. That was a very fast translation because the boat surrendered at sea, and by the time they got her in, it was pretty close to the 23rd. I think she got into port around the 20th of May.
Okay. So everything was obviously offloaded from the boat.
Correct.
And transported to America.
It was offloaded in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Right there.
But where did it go?
It went to that black hole.
It went into that same warehouse where Indiana Jones is.
That's right. So they got a 262. We have pictures of that up. These are obviously artist concepts.
Right.
But you get the idea.
Not the boat was aboard.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right. Hold on a second. We'll come right back with Harry as we continue with the story of the U-234 in just a few. Okay, welcome back. Talking to Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, about the U-234. An extraordinary story, an extraordinary cargo. This cargo was... Talk about a prize of war. Wow. Now, the Americans must have been just elated to get hold of this. Imagine what they were doing with it in the Pentagon. Not that they took the U-234's uranium to the Pentagon, but the paperwork, the documents, and certainly the people. You have a photo of the scientist who was on board as well. What was
Dr. Schlicka.
What was Dr. Schlicka's specialty?
His specialty was magnetic. Supply suppression to try to make submarines more invisible to anti-submarine forces on the surface.
Uh-huh. Did you ever get a chance to talk to him?
No, we exchanged letters. He was a member of Shark Hunters, and we exchanged letters, but unfortunately, he passed away before we could get mm-hmm. too far into detail. He was not a kid. He was into his 80s, I think, so he uh-huh. just passed away. He died right. in Milwaukee.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you've been getting our magazine. I've sent you a magazine every month.
Right. And thank you, yeah.
I hope you find it interesting. And if your listeners would like, all they have to do is send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net. Ask for a sample magazine. We'll send them a free sample magazine electronically.
This is a real peek at history that you won't find anywhere else. They're doing so many things there. Let me ask another question. Now, these boats that went down, the other five, let's just say there were six, and they had advanced technology on board. Without disturbing the site, would any of that technology be worth going after today in a very respectful way?
I understand what you're saying in a respectful way, but I personally think it would be waste of time because the technology has gone way past what they had on board.
Understand.
So there would be nothing to be gained other than just historical notes. The nuclear, that was my career field in the Air Force, was thermonuclear weapons. And we saw films on the early days of the American nuclear technology, and we were lagging. We didn't have this. We didn't have that. And then when the war ended, suddenly we had atomic weapons, and we were never told in tech school where we got all this stuff. We were just told that we had it suddenly. No American technological breakthrough, I guess, is what we were told.
Right.
But it appears that it came from Germany. And this is kind of connected, kind of off the wall, whatever. We really believe that we got this in exchange for not chasing after Adolf Hitler. As you know, we've gotten documents from the FBI, the OSS, et cetera, that he did indeed get away to South America. I was in the estate where he lived. I talked to people that knew him down there. And there was no attempt to go after him. And we theorized that was the deal. The Germans gave us whatever they gave us in exchange for us just turning our back on what happened to Hitler, let him live out his life down in South America, which he did. Nice area, too. Argentina is a beautiful country.
What I understand is it's gorgeous.
Yeah, and your Yankee dollar packs a punch down there. Their inflation is getting away from them again, but you can live pretty good on a small amount of Yankee dollars.
Right. Okay, what happened to the U-234 after it was stripped of cargo and so forth? The last picture kind of tells the story. And my question is, why would they scuttle or destroy so much of this equipment when it could be studied, it could be mothballed away? I mean, didn't people have any vision there, or did they just want to eradicate every possible remnant of the so-called enemy?
I think they got most of what they needed off that boat. That boat was the technology of submarines had gone way beyond the Type 10B. At the end of the war, there were 200 and something, like 230, 250, something like that, German U-boats surrendered in Northern Ireland. And so what are you going to do with them? The ultra-high-tech ones, like the Type 17s that had the hydrogen peroxide engines, the Brits kept them to study them, but the rest were all Type 7, which you see in all the Wolfpack movies, or the Type 9 long range like U-505 in Chicago. And so there was no real need for them. A handful of the boats were given to the French, another handful. There were four given to the Norwegians. There's only one left, and that was U-995, which was given to the Norwegians. They operated her as the boat Kaura, and then they offered it back to the German government, which of course said, no, we don't want, World War what? Adolf who? No. But the German U-Boat Veterans Association had a ton of money, and they bought it for, you know, next to nothing, but they've got it on display out of more than 800 Type 7 boats. That's the only one left in the world.
Wow.
So they had no real need for these boats because their technology was, you know, last year's technology. So they took them all out to a deep trench northwest of Ireland and just pulled the plug on them, or some they used them for targets, but they they sank 200 and something submarines.
Wow.
Because they had nothing, no use for them.
Well, it seemed they could have now used the metal, but I guess not.
Yeah, there was a group that came along, a group of Brits. Our business advisor wrote their business plan for them and also their marketing plan. Each one was about the size of a Manhattan phone book. This group was, got permission from the Crown. They were going to salvage some of these boats because they didn't all make it out into the deep water. Some went down in 100 feet of water. They were going to salvage these boats because their metal, their steel was made before the nuclear blast at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and also the test blast. So this would be good for surgical steel because it had no traces of radiation. But I guess they ran out of money because they didn't salvage the first boat at all. But there was nothing to be gained by using these old. They would have been nice to put them into a museum or something like that, but they weren't thinking about that at the time. They just wanted to get on, send the guys back to selling shoes at Sears or whatever the guys were doing when they got drafted.
Okay, so U-234 was, that photo looks to be a periscope photo.
That's correct. USS Greenfish fired that torpedo. And that was the end of U-234. She's down, if memory serves me correctly, I don't have my my documents in front of me, but she's to the west of Cape Cod and down in about 400 feet of water. And there won't be anything left. You know, the sea is not very kind to steal.
Exactly. All right, the crew were repatriated, I guess, fairly shortly thereafter, back to post-war Germany, which was in ruins.
Yeah, the officers were held at a place called Papago Park, near Scottsdale, modern-day Scottsdale. And Failor was one of the guys. This is something nobody ever hears about. You hear of the Great Escape, where the Brits tunneled out of a German camp. Well, there were 62 German submarine officers tunneled out of Papago Park, and Failor was one of them.
Huh.
But here they are. They're tunneled out into the Arizona wilderness.
Yeah.
Well, they have no money. They can't speak English. They're in the middle of the desert.
Bit of a problem.
Yeah, bit of a problem. And the Army offered a reward. If you captured one of these guys and brought him back to the prisoner camp,
uh-huh.
gave you $25. But if you captured him and the Army had to come get him, they only gave you $10.
You got to be kidding.
Well, it was worth more back in those days than money is worth today under Obama.
That's money's worth nothing now.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But they all ultimately surrendered. The last one to surrender was another guy who was a member of Shark Hunters, Jürgen Wattenberg, who was a training officer. He was on board he was navigation officer on the Graf Spee when that one sunk itself in 1939. And when he finally got back to Germany after they were 2 years in the U.S., he became the general manager and CEO of the St. Pauli Beer Company.
St. Pauli Girl.
Yes,
I think
that's
the
correct.
Name of it. Yeah,
yep.
It's still around.
That was Jürgen Wattenberg. That was that guy. Failor went back into...
What did you say? Wattenberg?
Yeah, Jürgen Wattenberg.
Uh-huh.
He was the guy who was St. Pauli Girl, the CEO. But Failor, the guy who was skipper of U-234, he went back into the Merchant Marine, the German Merchant Marine, after the war was over.
Still in love with the sea.
Oh, yeah. He was a character. He had been a merchant skipper before the war, and then when his daughter was born, and he was well into his 40s by the time his daughter was born, he used to drink a lot with this one particular priest, so they decided they were going to christen his daughter. They took the ship's bell off the merchant ship that he was master of and took it down to the local pub, filled it with water from the bar tap, and his buddy, the priest that he drank with, blessed it, turned it into holy water, and they baptized his daughter with water, holy water out of ship's bell in a bar in Hamburg, Germany.
Right.
He was a fun guy.
Yeah. Very good. All right, back with Harry in a minute. What do you want to talk about next, Harry?
Well, we can continue on this, or you want to talk about Adolf and Eva Braun getting out of Germany, going down to South America?
We can do that, too. We have a lot of folks listening, and there's so many different subjects. We can talk about that. We can talk about certainly the Luftwaffe, whatever you want. We could spend weeks doing this. Hold on just a second. We'll come right back with Harry Cooper, SharkHunters.com. Okay, back with Harry Cooper talking about World War II and the German U-boat war. The German Navy at one point was quite a force. You mentioned the Graf Spee. There were other tragedies and losses as well. Did the Germans ever really have a chance to rule the seas in World War II?
Not really. No, the Royal Navy was incredibly huge and powerful. And according to, under the terms of a treaty, I think it was 1935 London Naval Accords or something like that, the German Navy was only allowed 35% of the strength of the Royal Navy, with the exception of the submarine force. There it was governed by a certain number of maximum tonnage total. So what they did, they underreported the Type 7, for instance, was referred to as the 500-ton U-boat, when in fact, it, depending on which variant, it was anywhere from 760 tons up to 1,000 and something tons. And the same with the Type 9 long-range boat. They listed that as 760 tons, when in fact it was over 1,000 tons for the smaller of the variants, and went up to like 1,600 tons. So they did indeed have a huge impact on the North Atlantic with the submarines, but they never really ruled the seas. They had two battleships, Bismarck and Tirpitz. Bismarck, as you know, came to a bad end.
Right.
Tirpitz, they were afraid to even let that out of Norwegian fjord, and it wound up getting sunk in the fjord.
Yeah.
They had battle cruisers like the Graf Spee, and Graf Spee got bottled up in Montevideo Harbor. And
wasn't there a recent effort, or some talk about trying to raise that boat or do something with it?
Yeah, there was some talk about it, but there's really not much left. Graf Spee was sunk in water that there was only about 6 or 8 feet under the keel.
Hmm.
So it didn't disappear beneath the waves like you see out in the North Atlantic where they go down in, 6,000 feet. This thing just settled onto the bottom, but it burned for days. So everything was pretty well melted, and then she was a hazard to navigation.
Got it.
In the mouth of the Rio Plate,
mm-hmm.
So the Argentine naval authorities blew up as much as they could.
Mm-hmm.
Now all that's left is a couple sticks sticking up out of the water, for lack of a better term, with lights on them to mm-hmm. warn people away. However,
right.
Every ship that goes up or down the River Plate dips their ensign as they pass the area of the Graf Spee.
Oh, interesting.
There's a huge monument on shore in Buenos Aires. And Langsdorff, of course, is buried there with great honor.
Well, very brave crew. There was 3-1 against them, as I remember.
Mm-hmm. There were three cruisers, but Langsdorff got suckered in. There was a lot of radio traffic back and forth between the aircraft carrier Ark Royal and two battleships that were also offshore. And that's why he decided to scuttle, because he didn't have a chance. Well, it turned out later those were false radio transmissions. It was two light cruisers and one heavy cruiser, the Ajax, Achilles, and Exeter. And they were all fairly well damaged. He could have come out full speed and outrun them and outgun them, but he thought there were battleships and aircraft carriers out there too, which is why he took his own life.
Interesting. Well, I didn't know that part of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot more, too. When they got down and pinned into, or before they ducked into Montevideo, Langsdorff radioed back to headquarters and asked if he could have permission to go into one of the hidden harbors. They had what they called unbekannt Plätze, which means unknown places. And when Canaris, who was in charge of all their Secret Service during World War II, when he was just a young Oberleutnant in World War I, he was on the cruiser Dresden, which was the only one of Admiral Graf Spee's cruiser force to survive a battle with the Brits around the Falkland Islands.
Uh-huh.
They went through the Straits of Magellan, and they scoped out all sorts of hidden harbors where a ship could hide. There were no docks, no repair facilities, no people, no nothing, just
sure.
places to duck into.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1938, the year before World War II started, the the old line ship, Schleswig-Holstein, went through there again and updated the specifics. We have some of the German sheets on that, data sheets, and it shows exactly which U-place this is and how to get into it and how you can hide.
Mm-hmm.
And so Langsdorff asked if he could duck into one of those, but he was denied permission. We figure because they were afraid the Brits might follow him and find this network of hidden harbors. But when all the shooting was done, their supply ship, the Altmark, disappeared for 3 months. And we figure Altmark went down there and hid out until she went back to that Norwegian fjord where the Royal Navy came on board, captured the ship.
You know, another thing that's very interesting, relics from the war are, I guess, still being sold at auction and just on the internet, such as pieces of crashed fighters from both sides in the war that are literally all over Europe. Many of those planes went down, and certainly parts of them are still around, landing gear and things, stainless steel pieces.
Sure.
Those are bringing money. Now, you have a show coming up soon that you're going to be going to. It's a very big Militaria program.
Right. It's the biggest in the world. It's called the Show of Shows, and it's put on by the Ohio Valley Military Society, OVMS, and it had been 1,800 tables, but this year they've added more room, and so they're 2,200 tables plus. And this is Militaria from all over the world, but about 80% of it is Third Reich, because that's where most of the interest is. There's some Russian stuff there, so from the Soviet days. But as you say, anything that is a relic of anything in World War II carries a fairly healthy price tag. We've got our own auction running right now. If your listeners would like to see it, they go to sharkhunters.com and then click on the large blue auction box, and it take you right to where we've got our auction items.
Very good. All right. Well, I'll talk to you again about this. This auction, 80% of the tables are German Militaria. Now, a lot of that, of course, unfortunately, is fraudulent. That's a big problem. There actually have been books written about how to tell and determine what's real World War II vintage and what was created afterward or even contemporarily.
Yeah.
So it's a real interesting thing. I would just really like to attend that. It would be a real treat to see history laid out like that.
Get up that way, stop by our table, and we're having a Shark Hunters get together that Friday night. It runs from 28th of February until the 3rd of March in Louisville.
Big. Oh, so this is in Louisville?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
At the Louisville Convention Center.
Yeah. Okay, we'll talk more in just a minute. Hang on.
Very well.
Okay, and we're back with Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com. Harry, when you see these shows, and this is obviously going to be a huge one, I'll tell a little story which I don't think I've ever told anyone before. Years and years ago, I met a doctor, an American doctor, who worked in a VA hospital in Virginia. And he came into contact with a lot of aging World War II veterans. And this must be 20 years ago now, almost. And a lot of these men came back somehow, either with or had shipped ahead of them, spoils of war.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
That's where a lot of this stuff comes from, as you well know.
True.
He would make the acquaintance of these men as a physician, and many of them had nobody to leave these things to. They had footlockers full of stuff, and he would buy it. He would give them money for it. You know, he said, look, I'm a collector. And they said, fine, you can have it. And he came up with some of the most amazing things. Monogrammed Adolf Hitler table linens, dishes, plates, cups, saucers, silverware, Eva Braun dresses, Eva Braun clothing, all real.
Yeah.
And he would send me pictures of these things. And also, he had a number of Hitler pieces of art. Not the great art that you'll see, and I have that coffee table book of Hitler paintings, and you probably have it too.
He was a pretty good artist.
He was a very, very good artist, and I was able to come up with five pieces of Hitler art. They were small. The largest was 8.5 by 11. It was an elaborate pencil drawing of a countryside scene. The other four were small watercolors, 3 by 5, in that range, small, 4 by 6, all real. And I made the unforgivable mistake of entrusting a World War II collector with these to have them further authenticated in terms of time, possible location. They were 1910, 1912. He sold them.
Yeah, I could see where that was going.
Yep.
Yeah, and by the same token, how many German U-boat guys had huge, thick photo albums, and they would loan them to somebody? That's the end of that story. You know, they never got them back. These things are worth a fortune.
I just, it boggles my mind.
I know.
I took the guy to court and won, got a judgment against him. He just declared bankruptcy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And he pocketed all the money, and sorry, Jeff, you're out the door.
That's right.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And it even goes beyond that. You know, you're mentioning fake stuff. And there was a fella, oh, he's dead now. He was a U-boat crewman. He was on U-505. He had been telling people he was the executive officer, which he wasn't. And he was telling people he was the central control room chief petty officer, which he wasn't. But he and his wife were, girlfriend at the time, were illegal aliens, and they were going to throw him out. I didn't realize he was a wheeler dealer, so I contacted Ronald Reagan, who was a member of Shark Hunters, and got this guy some help to stay in the country. I was visiting him, and I found he had a whole huge carton of reproduction U-boat war badges. Like about 300 of them. So I said, what's this? He said, well, you know, I was awarded the U-boat Kriegsabzeichen. I said, yeah, you were awarded one. You got about 300 here. He was taking these repros to shows and selling them as if it was his own wartime badge. And this was from a guy who was on the boat. So naturally, you're going to believe him.
Yeah.
We threw him out of Shark Hunters, and he's dead long since, but. You know, I think I can say unashamedly that there's maybe only four people in the world that know the history of the U-boats better than I do. I do this 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. But
yes.
When it comes to artifacts, I'm dumber than a stump. These reproduction fakes
mm-hmm.
are so real
mm-hmm.
that even sometimes the best experts get fooled. So we neither buy nor sell actual artifacts of the war. We have video DVDs and
sure.
things like that, but as for real artifacts, we stay away from it because you can get burnt so badly.
So if somebody were to go to this show in Louisville and see World War II German military, which is, again, 80% of the business now.
Right.
What should they and shouldn't they buy?
That's like asking how much is a used car worth.
Isn't that the truth?
It varies, you know, whatever the person's interest is. Some people like uniforms. Some people like edged weapons. There's a couple of guys there who are some of the top experts in the world in edged weapons. But this stuff ain't cheap. This stuff isn't cheap. Just a dagger, a dress dagger for the SS, for instance, even in crummy shape, you're looking at $1,000.
Well,
and when they're in really good shape, and especially if they belong to, if they can be documented to belong to a certain person, they're worth a whole lot more.
Well, there is provenance to some of these things. I've seen some very well done pieces that were backed up all the way, even with photographs.
Oh, sure.
And so forth. And so you'll see that there too.
They're real. And Jeff, you better bring the big wallet when you go to get some of that stuff.
Yeah, I know. I've often wondered if my paintings or my little pieces of art had shown up in these things. Do you ever see any art? Probably not. Those are all in collections by now, I'm sure.
Yeah, true. About the only art we see are actual recruiting posters and stuff like that.
Sure.
Some of those are real. Some of them are clearly listed as reproductions. But there's a couple of other Shark Hunters members who have a booth there, and you're looking at massive money. The award document for Otto Kretschmer's crossed swords to his Knight's Cross with Oakley, just the document, and it's going for $250,000.
This is incredible.
Yeah. There are collectors, and Eric Topp, the third most successful submarine commander of the war, he sank the Reuben James in error, etc. He had an honors dagger, which Dönitz had given him. No, it was Rader, Admiral Rader, who was before Dönitz. And Rader's autograph signature was etched into the blade. There were only six of these ever made. Mm-hmm. Top had one of them. Mm-hmm. Somebody broke into his house to steal it because they had offered him $350,000 for that thing. He said no. So they came and took it.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of world we live in. But the question remains for some people, and they can never understand it, is why the fascination with the evil German Empire and the arch-Satan Hitler. And I think the answer is quite clear, because that really isn't at all the truth.
You're right. You're right. It's not at all the truth. It's not even close to the truth.
No.
These guys were brave, honorable, decent men. They fought bravely.
They're fighting against insurmountable odds. They shoot down one B-17. The Americans would build 20 more. I mean, it's crazy.
There's just no way you could overcome that. I think we looked at some files, and the United States built more machine guns every month than Japan built the entire war.
Wow. So, well, there you go.
Liberty ships, we're building them in a day. You sink a ship, got 10 more to replace it.
That's the way it is.
Yeah.
Hold on just a second. We'll come right back with Harry as we continue. Okay, and we're back with Harry Cooper. Politically, the Germans knew what was going to happen to Europe after the war ended, and they knew early on. They knew by 1942-43. They knew who the bankers were. They knew where the money centers were. They knew who was financing all sides in the war. They knew who was going to ultimately benefit, no matter who won. This was not a secret. And exactly as the Germans and others predicted would happen, has in fact happened to Europe. Nothing of any great surprise. We've seen history play out almost perfectly as it was predicted.
Yeah, that's true. One of the problems Patton had was not so much that he kept wanting to rearm the Waffen-SS, who were probably the best fighting men of the war. He wanted to rearm them, as we know, and march east against Moscow. But he also kept asking embarrassing questions like what happened to the $2 billion worth of gold that evaporated out of the Reichsbank after the Allies overran it. It went to went into somebody else's bank.
It didn't go to Fort Knox.
No, I don't think it did. Most of it went to Russia, but some of it went to U.S. banks.
Tell us more about Patton and how he knew what was going on and why he was murdered. That's a very big story.
Yeah, I'm not the real expert on that, but what we've learned, of course, is that he was murdered. You know, before I got involved in this, you hear the story, he was killed in a car crash in Germany, broke his neck, and so you get the visual image that, okay, here's this wrecked car, and there's dead Patton in the back seat with a broken neck, and that's not the way it happened at all. He was recovering in a hospital, and he, from what I understand, he had told some friends of his that he knew he was marked for death, and that ultimately happened. And as I say, he kept asking what happened to the $2 billion worth of gold that disappeared out of the Reichsbank. And like I say, I'm not an expert on this, but most of it went to Russia, and some of it went to American banks in New York.
Right, right.
And the same thing happened with the treasures of Troy. Many, many years ago, the subject came up. So-called experts were wondering what happened to the treasures of Troy, because Schliemann had found Troy back in the 1930s, and he brought all these treasures back to Germany in a museum, and they disappeared. And so people were looking, you know, what happened to them. So we reported, thanks to our contacts with the former Soviet, we reported that this was all in Soviet possession. And then finally the Soviets admitted, or the Russians, because the Soviet Union was gone, the Russians admitted, oh yeah, well, we have all that stuff here, all them gold pitchers and stuff, but don't worry about it, it's ours, so we're taking good care of it.
Right. How much of the upper level of the German government got away? The highest levels. We'll talk about Hitler and Braun as well, but how many of them made it? Go ahead.
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of it is still hidden. Adolf Hitler got away. He died in 1962 in Cordoba province of Argentina. Eva Braun, as of the year 2004, we had indications she was still living, which, it's not that difficult, because she was born in 1912. So in 2004, she would have been, 94 years old. That's not unheard of. The biggest mystery is Hans Kammler. He was a doctor of engineering. He was the third most powerful man in the Reich. Number one was Hitler. Number two was Bormann.
Hmm.
And we know Bormann got to South America.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go back and forth to Europe. He was well covered. But the third most powerful guy was Hans Kammler. That we can only find two pictures of him at all ever taken of him in his life. And he was in charge of all the special weapons. And his headquarters was the Skoda plant in Prague. He was in charge of their atomic weapons program, the V-1, the V-2 bomb, the A-9, A-10 intercontinental ballistic missile they had pretty well perfected, the jet fighters, the rocket fighters, everything, the Type 21 submarines. He was in charge of all of that. And when the war ended, he just evaporated. There was there are three scenarios that no proof for any of. One, he just decided he didn't want to be captured by the Americans, walked into the woods and shot himself dead. Number two, his SS officer marched him into the woods and shot him dead, and then an SS guard shot that SS officer to prevent him from talking. This all sounds like remakes of the old John Wayne movie.
Yeah, that sounds a little overly dramatized.
Yeah, and the third one, he disappeared, and the big Ju-390 aircraft that was assigned to him also disappeared.
Hmm.
And we have reports of it being seen in South America. Nothing nailed down and confirmed yet. But we're still, I'm still trying to scrape.
You think that plane could still be down there then?
We're told that it was cut up, and the engines dropped into a river. We're still trying to put together some money to go back down there. It costs about $5,000 every time I go down there.
And
thanks to Barry in the White House, everybody's broke. Barry being Barack Obama.
Well, you call him what you want.
That's his real name, Barry Satoru.
Being very polite, I don't think he deserves even that much.
Right. I'm not one of his fans either.
Yeah.
But you got to admit, he cannot be called a traitor, because you have to be a citizen of that country before you can betray it. But that's another whole story, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. The best documentary ever about this guy is called Dreams from My Real Father.
Oh, yes.
You've seen that, I assume, and it explains his father was Frank Marshall Davis. We know
right.
that. And how he got his Marxist training and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and there's all those nude photos of his mother.
Exactly.
Yeah going exactly. around the Internet. So, but anyhow, I'm not an expert on that.
Well, who would want to be?
I don't Some of the other guys that got off to South America, Kurt Tank, the guy who designed the Focke Wulf FW-190, which they called the Butcher Bird because it was such a great fighter.
Yeah.
He didn't want to go to the Soviet Union. He didn't want to get scooped up in Operation Paperclip, so he went into Denmark and somehow got across the Denmark Straits into Norway, and from then went down to South America. He designed jet fighters for some of the South American air forces, and his children still live in the town where he retired, which is the same town where Hitler lived until 1955 when he had to leave. His children still live there, Kurt Tank's children. There was also Dr. Richter, who set up an atomic research laboratory on an island in a huge lake down there in Patagonia. And again, this was in the little town of San Carlos de Bariloche. All these guys wound up going to San Carlos de Bariloche. Also, Priebke, Erich Priebke, I don't know if you know that name.
I don't know that name, no.
Okay, he was an SS officer, not a high-ranking one. He was at the level of a captain, I think. And at the end of the war, some partisans in Italy killed 11 SS soldiers. And so according to a treaty, I guess, they were allowed to execute 10 civilians for every soldier that was killed by partisans. And Priebke didn't want to be bothered with it. The war was almost over, but on direct orders from Hitler, he had to go and execute 330 Italians. So he went to the mayor of Rome and said, hey, look, I got to do this. You have some criminals who are on death row or something like that, we can do that. Okay, so they marched him into the caves outside of Rome, shot them all dead. Okay, war was over. He wound up down in San Carlos de Bariloche. Unfortunately, somebody didn't count well, and there were 333 instead of 330. He was allowed to shoot 330, but three other people. So this nitwit Sam Donaldson went down there, you know, the guy with the fiberglass toupee.
Yeah.
He went down there, and he outed Priebke, 1995, I think this was, on national television. So there was a huge uproar. Priebke was arrested, brought back to Italy, tried in a military court, and found not guilty of any war crimes. He went back down to San Carlos de Bariloche, and more outcry from I think you can fill in the blanks. And Priebke was brought back and tried in a civilian court, found guilty, and he is still under house arrest for the rest of his life. He turns 100 years old this summer. But he was living in the same town. It's amazing how all these guys wound up living in the same little town, down which was about 700 miles southwest of Buenos Aires. And at the end of the war, I mean, it wasn't like you could jump on a jetliner and get there. You had to really want to go there. You had to take a train and then go by either truck or horseback the last 40 or so miles. So that's where a lot of these guys wound up.
Well, it's a hell of a lot better than Spandau.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, of course, Spandau no longer exists.
Yeah.
The old fortress is still there. We tour that, but, you know, we take people on history tours to Europe, and that's on our website. But the prison at Spandau, ever since old Hess decided he was so happy he was going to be released,
mm-hmm.
he hanged himself. That's
right.
What people do when they get happy, I guess.
Always, yeah.
Yeah.
When, severe genetic flaw the species has.
Yeah, especially when there's two SAS guys helping you tie the rope.
Indeed,
or
indeed.
The lamp cord it was.
Yeah. Harry, thank you. I salute you and all of your members, all of you folks listening. You participated, many of you, in an extraordinary part of history, and those who are honoring that are to be honored as well. Both sides of the war, all combatants, all armies had extraordinary, heroically brave men and women, and let's just hope we never see another war like that.
That's for sure.
All right. Thanks, my friend. Take care.
My pleasure. Have a good show.
Okay, thanks, Harry.
Bye-bye, Jeff.
Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com. Be right back.